Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Friday, July 22nd, 2022. As always, we are grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice. On the website at whyagain.org, if you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been gifted. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. You can download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have called in and been stepped through the worksheet process. And as we like to say, that listening to those repeatedly forms a very effective tutorial to help you get far more effective, efficient benefits from the tools, especially if you happen to be in a situation where you can't listen to the show live, call in for yourself and ask questions, or have a support group in your area where people can support you in working through the worksheet process. It's very useful to have those recorded examples of people working through the worksheet process. And by mimicking that, you can get powerful results for yourself. I should mention that we've been working through The Way of Mastery since January 10th, and the edited first half of our two-hour show is the first hour that's devoted to it's just this process of the first hour that we've been reading and commenting on, very slowly going through The Way of Mastery. That's available on the website at mindshiftersacademy.org. And there's a page where there's just five or six files and the highlights of that process that we've been doing since January 10th. And there's another page that has almost every show we've done since July 10th, 5 days a week. So you can go back and listen to either the commentary on reading and commentary of lessons 1 through 16, or, as we've done in the past couple of days, and there's a couple sprinkled in there, shows where we've just had questions and comments and discussion of the Way of Mastery process as a set of tools for learning to live less from the intellect and more from the heart, more from the awakened heart, more from a connection to creativity and intuition and aliveness that the churning of my intellectual mind cannot offer me. And the last 2 days, we've been blessed with people raising their hands and commenting, and the entire show was just a review of and or discussion of how to apply some of the concepts that Lesson 16 is introducing us to. And Lesson 16 is, to my way of thinking, just there to busy our conscious logical minds and stretch them a bit as our conscious logical minds try to wrestle with self-contradictory statements in a way to consider that the world itself is not as black and white as our intellectual processing would have us believe, as our training and conditioning from culture and family would have us believe, that there is a lot more going on here than what meets the eye. And by way of bringing that point home, I remember that I'd seen this, I shared this thing earlier this week. It's just a statement about how clearly we think we know what's going on, and we have no clue. And this is the way it's, I've come across this in a variety of different places, probably several dozen over the years, from different scientific research. Michael Rice likes to quote the idea that there's Harvard research that says, in the period of time where they can measure 10,000 units of electrical activity in the human brain, which is, you know, a period of about 1/25th of a second, in that period of time, we can only be aware of about 9 bits of information. Our brain is probably processing 10,000 bits of information. And one of the many ways to say it is there are probably over 20 trillion bits of information registering in our senses. So we're living in a 20 trillion bit world. This is the way Dr. Michael Rice would say it. We're living in a 20 trillion bit world. Our brain, that hard drive in our body, is picking up input from the senses and only processing 10,000 out of the 20 trillion. And our conscious logical mind lets us be aware of 9 individual single bits of information. Now, add that to here's another way to talk about it. You can see, the human eye only sees less than 1% of the electromagnetic spectrum. And the human ears hear less than 1% of the acoustic spectrum. You probably aren't aware of this from your physical senses, but as you're hearing me read this, we are traveling at 220 kilometers per second across our galaxy. 90% of the cells in your body carry their own microbial DNA, and they're not part of you, quote, you, close quote. the atoms in your body, every atom is 99.99999% empty space. And none of the atoms that are in your body today are the ones you were born with. And yet, every atom we know of originated in the belly of a star. We think of ourselves as so much above everything else and sophisticated. We have 46 chromosomes, but that happens to be two less chromosomes than the common potato. We look up in the sky and we see a rainbow and we think, oh, how beautiful that is out there. But the fact of the matter is the existence of the rainbow depends upon these conical photoreceptors in our eyes. And for people without that or animals without that, rainbows don't exist. They get the rainbow, the experience of a rainbow gets created inside our brain and translated to these signals that's interpreted by our mind as these colors. So you don't just look at a rainbow, you create it. And that's amazing, mind-boggling, when you think about the fact that your eyes are only registering less than 1% of the electromagnetic spectrum. We see the rainbow and we think, oh my God, look at all those beautiful colors. Imagine what's there that we can't see if we're only seeing 1% of what's in the electromagnetic spectrum. It's these kinds of things that the way of mastery is trying to help us open up to. And when I say open up, I mean open myself to having an experience of it. Not think about it, but understand that when somebody tells me your eyes are only registering less than 1%, less than 1/100th of what exists in the electromagnetic spectrum, when somebody tells me that, I use my mind to realize I can't even comprehend what it would look like if I could see 20% or 50%. Because right now, there are times when it seems like there's too much stimulation coming at me. If I go into a crowd or if I'm out in the woods and there's a noise over here and a crackling branch over there and a bird chirping over here, and it feels like I can't keep track of it all. And I'm only registering less than 1% of what's there in both sight and sound. I won't even go into the physical touch because it's the same thing. There are all kinds of things that are energies that my senses physically will not register. So we get to sit with the realization, the awakening to the fact that we are trained by our culture to believe we can know what's right, we should know what's right, we should have the pat answer. It was like I was talking about the talk that was given by David White, the poet, a week ago last Sunday. And he talked about how we're raised in this culture and we're plopped in these chairs in school where we're only rewarded for having a pat answer, a simply stated, direct, right or wrong, good or bad answer. We are not encouraged to live in the space of questioning, which is so vital for learning anything. We're more trained to go after an answer like we would if we're on a hunting expedition for food for the dinner for our tribe for tonight, because we're not out there just to look at all the different kinds of animals and explore their habits. We're there to just kill one of them and bring it back for dinner. Well, that's essentially what our educational process is like. It's very limiting. It's more like pounding stuff into us rather than, as Michael Rice would say, the root of the word education is educare, and it means to draw out. Rather than having us live in the question and have people draw out of us our questioning ability and our ability to learn and expand and tune into what we have a passion for as individuals, and then allow children, as they do in the Montessori methods and some other methods, to explore what they have a passion for in the moment. Rather than that, almost everyone who's listening to this has been raised in a culture, in a school system, that says there's a right answer and a wrong answer, and you're going to get penalized if you give the wrong answer, and you'll get slightly rewarded if you get the right answer. And that is absurd when you consider how little of life, of the energies that make up life, we register with our senses. And again, I just flashed on the idea that came to me somewhere in high school, because I remember being introduced to the periodic table of elements when I was in grade school, and they said, these are all of the elements in the universe. Everything is made up of these, and that's all there is. And by the time I got to high school, they'd added a couple new ones. And because they'd added a couple new ones, they had to change what they said. And so they said, these are all the elements in the known universe. Because by then they'd realized they don't really know that much, and their knowledge is expanding exponentially at times. There were things that I was taught about the human brain and about how in the human body, the only cell in the human body that can't regrow or heal itself is the nerve cell. So once there's a damage to a nerve cell and that function is lost, there's no recovering it. Well, sure enough, by the time I got into college, they were talking about we're seeing evidence that nerve functioning can regenerate, whether it's in the brain or in different parts of the body. And so I quit thinking in terms of what I know and trying to proselytize about what I know and trying to convert people to understand that what I know is the truth because I've been to college, etc. And I started adopting the position that says, well, this is what I currently think I know based on the best information I have right now. And it's subject to change. As a matter of fact, sometimes it changes on a daily basis. That's the kind of perspective that the Way of Mastery is offering, is inviting us to embody, to step into. Please understand, you don't know anything. There's even an exercise in the first few lessons about picking up objects, looking at your hand, looking at the tree in front of you when you're outside, and just questioning for yourself, who was the human being who had the first idea for a pen? Where did the materials come from that make up this pen? Some of them look like they're metal. Some of them look like they're plastic. How did this get here? When is the first time that I came into contact with this particular pen? Did I see it at a store and buy it? Did somebody else give it to me? Did I find it on the side of the road? Was I at a networking event and somebody gave it to me as a giveaway because it's got their name on it? Just questioning so that I open myself to realizing I really don't know very much about myself, the people around me, and the physical things around me. And this is a wonderful exercise to just step into the actuality rather than continue to plod through my life with the active dream going on, the active belief about control and I forget the other word I'm thinking of here, but consistency, because the only thing about our lives that's consistent is that it's all energy in motion, and all energy in motion changes. So, right, there's a level at which, for periods in my life, I'm going to feel like, yep, this is always the same. I can always come back to this lake where, you know, I was raised on this lake, and it's always the same. The frogs are there, and there's a level at which, at a level of scale, that's true. But there's another level at which that lake is always changing. By way of example, I grew up, and there was a pond off of our backyard. And there were fish in there, and you could canoe on it or have a little rowboat on it. And it would freeze, and we could ice skate on it in the winter. And it was as I grew up, it was always there. But as I got into college, that pond was changing visibly from the way it was when I was a child. And the visible change was that at the mouth of it, the creek or the little river that fed it was filling up with soot. And so unless there was a heavy rain and the pond was flooding, the creek that fed it, or the little river that fed it, was becoming just a creek, just a rivulet of water. Because these weeds would grow in it every summer, and then they would die, and they would form a silt at the bottom, and then year after year, that silt built up until the depth of 2 or 3 or 4 feet was now only 1 or 2 feet. Well, we have this wonderful thing called Google Maps these days, and I can go on Google Maps and go on the satellite image and go back to the house that I grew up in and look at what used to be a pond in the backyard, and it's all filled in with weeds. It is a bog or a swamp. Everything changes, and we create an image of stability and consistency that is just a fantasy. And the way of mastery is trying to help us open to a different level of engaging life day to day, which gives us more flexibility for learning, which opens us to experiences beyond just what the few little inputs of the senses are, and give us a predisposition to growing rather than stagnating. You know, I remember Guy Finley had a thing where he read what his version of what he called a Mozart quote. And Mozart, this fabulous composer, this genius, this person who clearly had a brain that was far more facile and active than the average person. And here's what Mozart wrote. I have never written the music that was in my heart to write. Perhaps I shall never with this brain and these fingers. But I know that hereafter it will be written, when instead of these few inlets of the senses through which we now secure impressions from all without, instead of these few tones of our little octave, there shall be an infinite score of harmonies, for I feel it. I am sure of it. The world of music, whose borders I have now only scarcely entered, is a reality, is immortal. So here's Mozart, who was getting impressions, getting the inkling that as magnificent, as full, as expansive as the music he was hearing and composing and writing and creating, as big as that was compared to other music that was available at the time, he could glimpse there was so much more. And that's what the Way of Mastery is trying to introduce us to from the very beginning, from the first lesson, and even more so by the time we get to lesson 16. It's trying to tell us, it's trying to help us step into the realization of what it points out, the Way of Mastery itself points out in the first lesson, where it says, the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. You cannot go where we are trying to let you go, help you go, introduce you to. You cannot get there through the conscious logical mind or the intellect. And yet, you're in a culture, you've been trained to believe that the intellect is you, and it is how you interact with the world, and it is the way you find problems, solutions to problems, etc. And so here lesson 16 says, let's talk about the birth of egoic consciousness. Let's help you understand that this thing that you call an intellect and the birth of an egoic consciousness, the birth of a sense that you're separate from everything else, came along way, way after the beginning of creation, the beginning of spirit, the beginning of consciousness itself. So lesson 16 as a lesson is titled The Birth of Egoic Consciousness. And the text reads, beloved and holy friends, it is a joy to communicate with you the way of transformation. Within the word transformation, there is great wisdom. Transformation requires that there be that which abides in form. You are that. You are abiding in form. You are energy which has been so lowered in its vibration, so slowed down in its vibration as to become perceptible to the human senses. And so much more. And you are spirit. The previous lesson, two lessons before, said you are infinite spirit. You are unlimited spirit. And as a part of unlimited spirit, you have a specific form of consciousness that this lesson calls egoic consciousness, which is a dream of separation, which is the illusion, the hallucination that you are separate from all other consciousness. You are spirit. You are that which has come forth as a ray of light, capital L light, from the mind of the Creator, as a sunbeam reaches out from a sun. In that formless beginning, consciousness itself. Now this is critical. Every word they put in here, they put it in for a meaning, a specific meaning. It doesn't say you were consciousness itself. It says you are. This is an attempt to use our language to discuss that which doesn't relate to time. You always were, you are, and you always will be. That consciousness, because that consciousness is not bound to the energy that you experience as your physical body. In that formless beginning, you are consciousness itself. You are intelligence itself. You are bliss. You are radiance. You are compassion. You are the potential for endless creativity. You are creation itself. Now, that is the first time that we have been quite so bold. It's the first time that we've described you as that which creation is. This can only mean that what you are in your essence is essential. It is creation itself. It is God herself, light itself, God himself, creation itself. The words are irrelevant. The experience is the goal. The experience of how energy is everything, everything is energy, you're something, that means your energy, all energy is connected to all other energy, that is something words can't describe. So then the text goes on and says, let's talk about the first level of creation. The first level of creation is pure spirit. The very first level of creation is that which we call God or the Creator or Abba, when the energy, when the existence, we just don't have words for it, because I say energy and we're talking about a time before energy was created. But when the Creator first began, the indescribable, the unexplainable mystery of birthing itself forth out of the eternal matrix of its being. This first level of creation was pure spirit, a subtle, subtle movement in which a gentle sunbeam begins to emerge from the sun, or a ray of light begins soundlessly to emanate from light itself. In pure spirit, you are unbounded. You are without form. You are pure consciousness. You are self-awareness. In spirit, there is only capital S self. There is no self and other. There's no self apart from self. No self apart from form. No self apart from consciousness, but simply capital S self. Radiant, shimmering, unbounded, alone and yet not lonely. Rather, filled with self, filled with creation, filled with capital L love, the creative energy itself. This first level of creation never changes. It is creation itself. It is God itself. It is light itself. For the sunbeam is as the sun, and the ray of light as the light. A momentum, though, has begun, a momentum extending from the pure potentiality of all that the Creator is, for love seeks only to extend itself. Extension is an activity. It is a movement. And for there to be extension, there must necessarily have been created what you call space. But even at this first level of creation, the space of which we speak is not quite what you would perceive in your mind as you think of that which contains the planets whirling around your sun. Rather, at this level of creation, it's more like a mathematical concept. It was the idea of space. It was the idea of space in which extension could occur. There were not yet any planets, any suns, any dust clouds. There was not yet a single atom or molecule of matter. There was pure thought, pure love, pure being, beginning to entertain, and I emphasize that word entertain for a reason, beginning to entertain the idea of pure space, pure extension, unlimited, unbounded forever. There was pure spirit. This is what you are, now and now and forever. Spirit does not change. So what is spirit? It's just a word we're using for that which never changes. that which was before everything thing and is now while things exist and will be after things don't exist. This book, The Way of Mastery, tells us a number of times, everything that is birthed in time ends in time. And it's not a death, it's simply a transition of energy form. But our science understands that energy can't be created nor destroyed, it just changes form. This is about the consciousness, the pure spirit, call it what you will, that existed before there was any solid thing. Try and wrap your mind around that and see how dizzying it gets. How could you be awake, aware consciousness when there is no mind, no body, no hand, no foot, no chair, no table, no planet, no sun, no... How could you be? Just be if there is none of that. There is that which in you, right here, right now, even as you are hearing these words, even as you perceive yourself as a body sitting in a chair, beyond all that you see with your physical eyes, all that you are aware of as and within the body, beyond the activity of the surface level of the mind, in which there is the firing of neurons in the brain almost without ceasing, so that the mind seems to never be without images and thoughts, that is spirit. Far beyond this planet, and yet right where this planet resides, far beyond this universe, and yet right where this universe abides, far beyond all dimensions, the infinite dimensions of creation, yet right where those infinite dimensions exist, spirit is. So here's another little paragraph of Cohen, of contradictory statements, of something to make your mind spin until it gets tired of trying to figure it out. Here, in pure spirit, is found what I have often referred to as, quote, the real world, close quotes. Here, peace abides eternally. Peace abides eternally with perfect consistency, without interruption. Here is the living reality, which has been reflected in the sentence, I and my creator are one. In other words, when consciousness transcends its perception of itself as being only conditional experience, being only the forms of existence such as the body-mind, the particular sense of self as separate from all other selves, the blade of grass, the cloud in the sky, the rock upon the ground, when consciousness transcends this sense of itself, it abides not in a thinking relationship. It does not observe spirit as something else and then says, oh, so that's what I am. Great. It doesn't do that. It understands, it experiences a level of unity, connection, oneness. These words really don't do it justice. Rather, there is a living sense in which consciousness as such, as the capital S self, rests in itself and simply knows. No thought involved, it's experience. For only knowledge is immediate and not mediated by any concept, form, or experience. So here they're using the word knowledge as that which is felt. Lived, embraced in actuality, not something that's ruminated about and had thoughts created for it so it can be communicated to another. Knowledge, the way they're using it in this book, is in the present moment, awake experience of something. In such a moment, it takes only a moment, there's an immediate awakening to the reality of the real world, capital R, real, capital W, world. This would be what Michael Rice calls the actuality of life, the world that the Creator created, not our images of it, not our perception, not our belief system. In some form, and notice I said some form, consciousness then dances back into the extension of spirit, into the extension of reality, into creativity, and into creation. In the human form, it can say, I and my Creator are one. There are many such statements within the human family that have been uttered to express that awakening and that reality. So there's this movement before time, before matter, before any idea of separation, there's this movement of extension and this idea of creating like a mathematical concept about how there might be extension when there is no form. When things are just staying at the wave level of energy. Nothing has condensed into a particle yet. The next section is titled The Creation of the Soul. Now, in this ceaseless movement from that which never moves, there's your koan. There, keep your logical mind busy with that one over the weekend. How could there be ceaseless movement from that which never moves? Just as the ray of light emerges from light divine, unbounded, eternal, unobstructed, in the very desire to be creative. That's what creation is. It's extension. The creative energy is always moving, changing, growing, extending itself, creating more. In the very desire to be creative, in the desire to extend creativity ceaselessly, and that is what creation is, within that, spirit begins to condense or descend, and we understand these are spatial terms, so it doesn't really make that much sense. But again, we are now using language that finds its source on your side of the fence with form and physical phenomenon, not on the side of the fence with spirit, where language is hardly needed. Spirit continues its dance as the one mind, God, entertains the extension of creation. And spirit begins to condense into something that has not yet ever occurred. The thought, and again, we are still operating at the level of pure thought, pure potentiality. There's not yet the deep darkness of space that you would call your universe or any dimension whatsoever. But the thought begins to condense into a thought of individuation. Perhaps you've seen in your television commercials when the milk is poured into the glass in slow motion. It splashes up from the bottom of the glass, racing up the sides. And it begins to move back up the sides to fill the cup. And at the last moment when they pull the milk away, the carton away, and that motion has stopped, the pouring motion has stopped, the motion that was started creates the phenomenon of a circular drop of milk that splashes up from the center of the milk. And for a very temporary moment seems to be separated from the body of the milk in the glass itself. It emerges for a split second, and you who are watching the screen have the awareness of the individuated drop of milk that seems to exist completely independent from the body of the milk itself. And then in the next moment, it drops back into the body of milk, and you lose your awareness of it as a separate thing. You lose your awareness of it as a separate drop of milk. But it is still milk. From your place of perception, it merely looked as though it had a separate existence. Now, that's an analogy, of course, because your soul is not made of milk. However, it does create a picture for you of what occurs when the body of spirit continues in its entertainment of creativity, out of which emerges what we have called soul, the first subtle inception of the thought of individuation, of that which is an individual expression of the fullness of spirit, of that which is light, of that which is creation itself. Why is this happening? All for the joy of creation, that one might be aware of itself in an endless variety of form. This is where it begins. This is the delight of creation. This is what you are. In pure spirit, there is still only pure potentiality. That's all there is. There has not yet been what you would know as an experience. There is, however, the first subtle awareness of the one, capital S, self, beginning to become aware of itself. Instead of just being extension, endless extension, and joy and bliss, it now begins to become aware of itself. And the next section is titled Separation is Birth. As the soul continues the extension of light, the extension of pure creativity, it condenses. It descends to the next, quote, level, close quote. What does that mean? The words can't describe it because there were no words at that time. There was no space. There was no mouth to speak words. There was no brain to process thoughts. So at the next level, there is this movement or descent. Again, we're still using language from your side of the fence. There are not many other ways to speak of this. The soul descends or condenses and begins to create a deeper awareness of itself as an individuated being, which just became a possibility a few milliseconds before, or a few eons before. It doesn't really matter because there is no time. So it could be a few thousand years before, it could be a half a breath before. There is no thing. And yet, there is this experience within spirit as being separate from other things because it's a form of play spirit wanted to experience. The text goes on and says, now its awareness of itself as spirit is taking on a new coloration, a new vibration. It is becoming very close to what many of you have experienced in your own meditations and prayer, or the time that you heard a child cry, or the time that you walked through a forest at dawn. When your egoic mind was temporarily transcended and you had a sense of your oneness with creation, and yet you still felt other than creation. You felt as separate. You felt as you were creator and creature. You felt you were an offspring from a parent and you felt united and yet somehow different. All of these things happen when we have a peak emotional experience or an awakening experience or a very deep meditation. Here's where the separation can be said to have occurred. When you have a belief that you're different. For it is here in the first level of pure potentiality of this unique thought that which intelligence is. Here is where intelligence is. Here is where love is. Here is where light is. I have referred to this in the Course in Miracles as capital M mind, which is not merely the prattling that goes on in the human brain that you refer to as thinking. Mind is much more vast than that. It is here in the first level of subtle perception of the self, again, capital S self, as an individuated matrix of awareness. It is here that this matrix has awareness of itself, and yet that self or creation is somehow something different than what the soul perceives itself to be. Here is where the first unique thought of separation is birthed. This is a very subtle point. Long before the planets of your universe arose, long before the multidimensionality of creation came into being, here you are. Here there is but soul, a unique expression of the one spirit itself, the unique expression of that one who eternally is. You are part of that. You are that. Imagining yourself to only be a part of it. Again, words fail us, but we're pointing in a direction. We're stretching the mind to start to consider how could this be. In the ceaseless movement from that which never moves. Here is the first unique thought of separation birth. At this very subtle point, long before the planets of your universe arise, long before the multidimensionality of creation came into being, here's where you are. Here there is but one soul, one consciousness, a unique expression of the spirit. It's itself the unique expression of the one who eternally is. Here, creativity itself, pure potentiality itself gives rise to the power of thought. It is from the field of thought, pure thought, that creation will now begin to spring immediately into being. Here at this subtle level, the drop of milk has seemingly separated itself and now feels awareness. Now, for the first time, it feels itself as a separate being from the body of milk, from the mind of the Creator. And for a moment, for just a moment, there is pure joy. Pure joy, because that's the word we use for the limitless extension of the creative energy. Because in that moment, before it has developed, it still understands it is the one mind, the creation itself, and that it's doing this little dance of dream of separation just for the entertainment purposes, out of pure joy, pure play, out of the sheer exuberance of extending itself and extending its infinite power ceaselessly without limitation. For you see, if the Creator, who becomes you, held the thought, well, I certainly can't separate myself from myself. If you were to think that, if creation was to think that, that would be a limitation. So the One, capital O, One, creates a drop of itself along with the perception that it perceives itself as a separate thing from something that is now for the first time other. Now, we're using this word other, but there was never any other, and there aren't any words at this time, and your mind should be spinning here. How could this book be talking about that which happened before there was mind, brain, body, soul, energy, physical expression, an atom, a cloud, a sun? But at that level, at that, I want to say point in time, but it's not, there is no time yet. So at that level, this is where the germination, where the seed for egoic consciousness was planted. But it's still a little further along in the story. The first thought of separation is dreamt, and a new energy is born. Prior to this, there was only the energy of extension and expansion and joy and aliveness and creation. Now, as there is this dream of separation, a new energy is born, and that new energy is fear. Because joy, life, love, creation is simply expansion, limitless, endless motion, expansion, creation. But when we start to have the thought of being separate from that which is ever-expanding, ever-changing, ever-growing, connecting all things, now we've created the hallucination or the belief in fear. Uh-oh. Now we're not endlessly extending, we're contracting. Here, extension is not born, but contraction is born, or the experience of contraction. And the word we have for that is fear. And fear emerges in our awareness. And from that point, the river begins to cascade very quickly. Out of fear, out of the first inception of the thought that I am alone, I am separate from my Creator. And yet, it's just, there is nothing but the Creator, and it's the Creator that's creating the experience of being separate. And in reality, the Creator is perceiving the Creator, creating the perception, etc. It's this endless cycle. Let your mind sit with that thought for the weekend. Enjoy playing with the concept of the ceaseless motion from that which never moves. Let your mind play with the concept that you are what was here before there was anything here or there. Before time, before physicality, before space. Let your mind play with that, and we'll reconvene on Monday. I thank you all for being here and listening. I'll remind us all that we come from this energy of creation that some call love. We're made of this stuff some call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome,
hello,
Jeannie
Dr.
Rice.
Yay.
Welcome.
Good conversation. I've enjoyed listening. Thank you. Hope
thank
you, have
you
a good
and
weekend.
You're most welcome. I hope you do too. Blessings.
Thanks. Thank you. Bye. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Friday, July the 22nd, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. We'll give Michael just a minute to dial in. And he has been out in the garden working most of the morning and fixing up the compost bins. And hold on. Okay, he'll be dialing in here in a second. But He's been out there working. I went out and lasted about 5 minutes and came back in. So I'm still in the process, but I am on the upside of this. So we appreciate everybody's thoughts and prayers. And we're moving on to the next level. So we're making some more changes on the website. The young lady who they host our site on their server, and she helps me do a lot of things. And we are changing the shopping cart. We've worked on this off and on a couple of times, and I think we've got it finally figured out how we're going to do it. And so that will be changing and a big upgrade. It'll look really nice. And so that'll be coming on here shortly. If you haven't downloaded the app, free, either in your Apple Store or your Google Play Store, either one. And all of the information that you put in it is totally private. It's yours. The only thing, if you click to send us your information, your name and email to put you on our mailing list, is the only thing that I get. Everything else is just totally on your phone. And there's two permissions. One is to use the internet, and the second one is if you decide to save your worksheets, to be able to access your files, to save it to your files. But those are the only permissions that we ask. So, well, Michael must be having a little bit of difficulty getting in. We'll give him just another minute. So if you have a question, please press 1. We'd love to hear from you. Look in the other room here and see if he's having a challenge. So, all right, he says he's with us now.
I am. Thank you, dear heart. Welcome, everybody. Moving forward with the conversation. Do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anything happening in the chat room, sweetie?
Nope, it is all quiet.
Well, here we are.
Well,
talking about.
Up.
Oh, well, let's go for it.
I believe it's Miss Susan 610. You're on the air.
Hi. First, thanks, Jeannie, for the little teeny-weeny report on yourself and on Michael being out in the garden. Congratulations. You're such a good sport. I think I would be giving a blow-by-blow account of all the weird things that happened in that bug, but you're just on the radio show doing your thing, which is, and you're talking about refurbishing the website. Good grief. I'm telling you. So,
well,
thank you.
Susan's going to actually carry a big part of that. Susan Garceau, yeah. So she just sends me stuff and says, what do you think about this? And I give her my opinion or tell her what I want her to change, and then she does it. So she's handling the bulk of it for me right now.
Well, you're still handling, and that's amazing. Yeah.
Yes, and I had as we were out working in the garden this morning, I had to shoo her back in the house. It's like, okay, you've done enough. Oh, well, I'm just going to do that. Go in the house and lay down.
Good.
But I had a good morning.
Good.
It's interesting, you know, we're taking ivermectin, and, you know, the promo in the culture is that ivermectin is a horse dewormer, which it is effective for deworming horses, but it's something that there are some 3.5 billion prescriptions that have been written for. It's cheap, cheap drug. There are no patents left on it, but about 3.5 billion human prescriptions. And it's been interesting. You know, last time that I had COVID, I used ivermectin for the first time, and what it at least causes both Jeannie and I to do is to sweat. And the sweating is very localized where it's needed. And the first time I had COVID, it was all lungs. I mean, every night my lungs would just, I could literally draw with a marker the shape of my lungs, and that's the only tissue in me that would sweat at night. And, you know, you would notice that the part of me that was impacted by the COVID experience this time was my throat. And last night before last, we took our second dose of it. And so I'm awake in the middle of the night, and my throat is sweating like, you know, again, just this little space between my right around my Adam's apple is just sweating like crazy. So it's pretty wow. Pretty interesting. I'm not one to use drugs, but it's interesting to watch what this has done and what it's doing. So I'm certainly holding in the blessing and appreciation. So how are you? What's happening in your world?
A little too much, and I'm going to give you a very short report, and then I may not be able to stay on. Luke doesn't have a car. He has totaled two cars, and so he doesn't have a car. His girlfriend drove him from their college area where he has a job to Jacksonville, and they bought some liquor on the way down. They picked up the youngest boy at my daughter's house, and then they went to get the liquor, but the youngest boy knows at 17 or whatever he is, and he was driving, I guess, by then. He said, "I can't drive you with liquor in the car. Why don't we stop at this park, and if you have to drink, you can do it there." Luke got totally smashed, which is he's doing it two or three times a week. Got ugly,
ouch,
which he does. I don't know the whole story. The short end of it is my daughter is driving him after a night of drunken punching one person, not my daughter, thank goodness, but his younger brother, and having a drunken fit and saying obscene things to his mother. She is driving him to a rehab place, and I don't know how she got him in the car unless he agreed to do it. And she has also told him that she cannot pay for college. Tim has been paying for his college, and she cannot pay his apartment rent if all he's doing is drinking. So all support systems have been taken away. Now, Michael, I remember ages ago you talked about you didn't believe in tough love, and I know you didn't mean it in a black and white way. They have tried everything, and nothing is working, and so he is, and he's suicidal, too. He's been, and she put him in the hospital part of the night, but he escaped or signed himself out, came back to the house and swept it off. She's exhausted, but she's driving him to this place, and I don't know anything more than that, but this is impacting Jacob, too, because Jacob uses stuff. He doesn't get roaring drunk, but he anesthetizes himself constantly. And
he heard
the news that all financial support is being pulled from Luke. And he said, "I think that's really mean." And I said, "It sounds horrible, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds as if the parents don't love him at all, but it's the most loving thing they could possibly do. Nothing else has worked. And they have been hurting him by paying his way. Look what's becoming of him." And Luke says, "Well, I don't agree." And he goes downstairs. And by the way, Michael, I showed him the poster. He said, "This is a scam. There's nothing to this. This is just a joke. I'm not going to pay any attention to this." We're working with some serious resistance here.
And denial is huge.
Yeah. And so, that's it. And he said, "Well, Luke's going to be homeless. I'll let him live with me in my apartment." And I said, "What a wonderful, loving thing to do. Go for it, because I know I can't argue with him." And he said, "Well, I don't know how it'll work out." And I said, "Well, what's the problem?" And he said, "Well, Luke might drink." And I said, "That's true. He might. What do you think?" And he said, so he's sort of talking himself both into the hole and back out. But I'm just sitting there, not doing anything. Except trying to stay sane. But I would love to ask for prayers for whoever's listening, Luke. And
we
both need a lot of something to see things differently, because they just think we're all out to get them, and they are in total blame mode.
Yes. Yeah, denial, results in that. It's like a religion. Carl Jung talks about we're religious animals, and if we don't have any religious practice, then we make one up. And the easiest religious practice to make up is everybody else is to blame for what's going on in me. And so let me go and exercise my pain, because everybody wants to inflict pain on me. And, of course, each time one goes out and anesthetizes their pain, they do more stupid things to cause more pain and go deeper into blame. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why, you know, in AA and such, they say you got to let them hit a bottom until they start to wake up and step outside of that blame game and realize some responsibility. It sounds like, you know, Jacob is able to see that if his brother stays with him, it's going to be trouble. And, of course, the trouble is because of the use of alcohol. You can see that in his brother, called to see in himself. And it's a tough one.
Oh, man. It really is. Anyway, that's what we're doing. And I listened to Dr. Tim, but Jacob's been wandering around, and I'm not sure what he's up to, so I may not stay on the show, but I'm going to hang in as long as I can. But thank you for listening to that, and keep getting well. I'm so glad you're able to be out in the garden. You must be sweltering out there. It's 97 or something here or whatever.
Well, it was 70 this morning. I got up early. I was up about 6:30 and got out there. It was still only 70 degrees.
91.
So got in 3 or 4 hours.
Ooh, down there.
Yeah, it's 91 now. 91. Oh, I think our high today is supposed to be something like 85, but we had a fairly cool morning. So.
That's good.
Yeah, the temperatures are crazy out at Heartland, you know, and the years that I've been there, we might occasionally hit 100 degrees in 2 or 3 days. And
yeah.
I don't know how many days they've had so far. The other day it was 107. It's like, this is just...
Wow.
But maybe
right? Maybe
somebody will pay attention to that. Yeah, it was 107 the other day. Yeah, somebody will pay attention to, maybe there's something to this global warming, and maybe we should start thinking about it rather than stuffing our pockets with money and pretending it. You know, it's actually the same game that's going on. The addiction to money has people, you know, I mean, I was listening the other day, and they said that one of the big oil companies had $20 billion in dividends, like record dividends. And yet their record or close to record prices in gasoline. It's like, wait a minute, how can you be making that much money? And this is a company that, you know, has acknowledged that, I forget, 20, 25 years ago, they knew global warming was true. And they financed scientists who would sell their lie that it had nothing to do with fossil fuels. And, you know, it's an addiction. It's denial. It's the same game.
Totally.
It's the major damaging factor in the world. And, you know, waking up to honor truth is it's a tough thing to do when your mind... You know, when you realize the challenge is that perception is constructed according to the way you see, the way you believe determines the way you see. And so when one builds a construct where they see that what they believe is true, they're like, well, see, look, I can see it. It must be true. It's like, well, actually, no, your mind's a liar. But it takes a great deal of work to wake up and realize that when there's pain, the mind's lying. It's a difficult thing to break through. I mean, look at the political situation and the viciousness, the violence, and the verbal violence and the physical violence. I mean, it's just. But it is definitely one of the challenges that once I. Choose to structure my world in a certain way and believe a certain way, then my mind shows me that I'm right. And to get through to the recognition that if I'm in pain, my thinking is in error and my perceptual constructs are incorrect, it's a huge piece of information, and most people aren't available to that conversation till they get to the bottom.
Yeah.
Whatever the bottom line, it's risky to go to the bottom.
Oh, you know, it totally
oftentimes
is.
Somebody who goes to the bottom, it's the end of their lives, too. It's you know,
I know.
Tough to watch, tough to hold space for. And to me, you know, when I've spoken previously about tough love, what I believe that tough love is an oxymoron. I think love does what is necessary, and if it's being done from an active space of love, when I say, well, I can't support your lifestyle because your lifestyle is killing you, and I cherish you enough, and I'm going to function as love, and so I'm going to withdraw support. I don't see that as tough love. I just see that as love doing the most positive thing for a person, even though that person may perceive it as pain and trauma. The experience is at least some of the things I've looked into on tough love, and I listen to the language of those who are saying they're doing tough love, and it isn't love at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's my take.
I guess I don't know what that is, because I think this is the best love I could give him, and my daughter does too, but it sure doesn't look that way to him.
Well, of course, the only thing that looks that way to him is kowtow to what I want, what my perceptual constructs say you should be doing. And of course, when you've got an alcoholic or a drug-addled mind, the demands can get pretty bizarre. And burnout, you know, sadly, one of the things they've recognized in, you know, let's say programs like AA is that the mind is so genius at its deception that it scams everybody out of everything they've got until people just finally give up in frustration and cut ties. And it's true within every drug. Hostility is a drug. It does the same thing. People playing the game from a perspective of hostility. It's, you know, in fact, you've heard me talk about the movie before, and it might be, this is a thought, just hadn't occurred to me before, but there's a movie called Thank You for Sharing.
Oh, I remember
and
that.
It's
yeah,
a movie about addiction. Might sit down with Jacob and have him, you know, invite him to watch a movie. And it's got some pretty profound stuff. But one of the most powerful things in that movie, at least how it appeared to me, and there are several different types of addiction portrayed in the movie, and several different people attempting to be responsible and deal with and get off of their addictive substance. But the thing that they did capture so powerfully is in each case, just before, whether it's a sex addiction or an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction, just before, or a hostility addiction, just before they fall off the wagon to their substance, they use hostility. That's the drug they use. You know, right up to the last second, it's hostility that they attempt to anesthetize themselves with. You know, there's one guy's like, you know, I don't want to use alcohol ever again. And hostility, and finally, when the hostility just isn't enough to anesthetize the pain, bingo, pull out the fifth of scotch, pull out the drugs.
Right.
And so, you know, you're getting to have a front row seat to that addiction to hostility, which precedes the use of just about every other drug. It's an attempt to anesthetize against the pain. And, you know, life without tools is hell. And the most, I think the most profound thing we can give somebody in that position is the tools. I've watched time and time and time again when somebody gets close to these tools and actually starts to use them, and I'm talking about severe addictions, they start to distance themselves from their addiction. Because if they'll use forgiveness, they'll remove some of the pain that drives them to drink, drives them to their addiction. And all of a sudden, they realize the addiction is is destructive. But they are able to do that because they're weakening or lessening their pain through forgiveness. And I've seen several people over the years who take these tools and use them, not even with the idea of stopping the use of alcohol or what have you. In fact, I think I sent you a link to the second two book study clubs back, and did a worksheet with a woman in the Hear My Voice book study out of London. And at the end of the work, we did a worksheet session with a woman who was totally new to the worksheet. It was about a 2.5-hour worksheet. But toward the end of it, spontaneously, I mean, we hadn't had any conversation about addiction or alcohol or anything else, but toward the end of the worksheet, as she was getting insight from the forgiveness process, part of that insight was, you know, maybe I need to stop drinking. Maybe I need to get rid of alcohol, was the insight she spontaneously had. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So any way that you can get that young man to sit with you, to bribe him or threaten, whatever you need to do, if you can get him to get some simple comprehension, the simplest worksheet, and cancel a goal and watch what happens. Maybe with Jacob, he could do one, you know, on his brother. You know, he's got some compassion for his brother. Well, you know, why don't we try this and see what happens? And who knows what might open up? But once the other side of the equation of how the drug and alcohol-addled mind can self-destruct, the brilliance and the genius that I see people, have seen people over the years take these tools, once they get the experience of that shift, the brilliance with which they use the tools is the other side of the equation.
Mm.
But you got to get them to do it once first.
Michael, can you actually help me frame a way to suggest, I mean, what about Luke would his brother do a worksheet?
Well, it sounds like he put forward, as I understood what your conversation was he was thinking, well, if everybody's cutting Luke off, I'll let him come and live with me. And then he could see, as I understood it in his conversation with you, he could see that could lead to problems.
Yeah, he already saw it almost immediately. Oh, yeah, he did. I said, well, how do you think, you know, how are you going to do that, you know, and what do you think is going to happen? And he says, I don't know. And then he said, I'm not sure it would work out. And I said, why not? You're giving him, you know, you're protecting him. And he said, well, he might drink. And I said, and then what? What would you do? And he stopped talking. He went down the basement.
Yeah. So there's your setup right there. There's your setup. You know, he knows.
Okay,
he stopped talking because he's probably going to start to realize, especially if he was sober at the moment he was talking to you, he's starting to realize that what he's thinking about his brother applies to him too. You know, like he's seeing that he's in the same position in relation to his chip to his brother if his brother comes and lives with him as he is to you.
I'm hoping
his brother's going to be to him what
I'm...
he is to you. And
yeah.
I can understand he'd stop the conversation and go downstairs at that moment because it's like, oh, my God, I'm talking about myself.
I know.
So there's where a worksheet could.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking is, what would you say? Who's the trigger? How do I feel? What's the goal? I don't mean to play dumb, but I feel dumb about this.
Yeah. So if you were Jacob at that point, I would probably frame it something like, so what I'm getting is that you would have a concern if your brother came to live with you, that there'd be problems from his drinking. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell you what. Let's do a simple step-by-step process. You know, you need some tools, son. You say you want to be an adult, and then you're playing like a kid, and you're seeing a problem here. So what if we did a worksheet on Luke and him coming to live with you? The problem would be that he'd be drinking. So what would it be that you'd want from him if he comes to live with you? Well, I'd want him to be responsible. I'd want him to be sober, so, you know, we don't have trouble. I want him to be happy. I want him to be successful. You know? So let's take the first one. So you're concerned about him getting drunk. So then you want him to stay sober. So let's make that the goal. If Luke comes to live with me, I'd want him to stay sober. That would be step 3. Mm-hmm. And then bring love present. And then bring that goal down. I cancel my need for Luke to stay sober if he lives with me. And see what pops. You know, it always amazes me from decades of working with people when they cancel that goal. I mean, you never know where the mind is going to go, because when that construct that's driven by that goal collapses, what a person gets in touch with under the surface is always shocking to me. I mean, the directions the mind goes when they cancel that goal is always amazing. So that might be a worksheet he could do and see where it goes.
That's a great idea. Well, he is very much at loose end now. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Another approach to take might be to carry on that conversation with him. You know, I noticed that you said you could have Luke come and live with you, and then you see problems because he might drink. So how about I'll do a worksheet and you support me with it? And I'm going to pretend that I'm you.
Okay.
And do that worksheet.
Nice idea. Mm-hmm.
And as you do that worksheet and cancel the goal for Luke to stay sober while he's staying with you and you're Jacob, what happens in Jacob's mind? And, you know, what when you cancel, so now you're role-playing Jacob, doing worksheet with Jacob there as support. And when you cancel the goal for him to stay sober, what comes up for you? Well, gee, there's going to be fighting and trouble, and
yeah, well,
that might
Michael,
be another.
He has gotten that far. He has gotten that far. He says, "Well, maybe I." He has gotten that far. He has said, "I don't think I can do it. Actually, I think he's going to trash my place, and he'll get drunk, and I'll say, yeah, I mean, that would be the way I'd be afraid too. I mean." You're helping him, but he's not taking advantage of the help. That's as far as the discussion has gone. He has kind of said, I'm going to do it. It's the loving thing, but I don't think I can do it because he won't comply.
So that might be the space to invite him to notice that you're having the same conversation with him and he won't comply. And he might start to get some of the projection that's going on. And again, if he could do that worksheet, he might get the experience of dropping into a saner part of his mind, because his mind knows. He knows what he needs to do to recover from this.
Well, Michael,
he's healthy enough. He's smart enough.
He is. Yesterday he was saying, I wish I could stop. I mean, why have nicotine? I'm a singer. I'm ruining my voice. And I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I just can't stop. And I think I'm going to have to be taken care of for the rest of my life. And I just can't go out there. And then he starts on me. He says, well, what about you? You're supported by your husband. And I said, but my husband got very mentally ill for a while. And he was not an earning person for a while. And I went to work. I had a million piano students. And I said, Tim, you're off the hook. You've supported me. Now it's my turn. And we went for a year or two with me seeing tons of, you know, piano students and, you know, reducing our costs. Again, he went silent. He said, well, I don't think I could do that. He doesn't have any confidence in himself at all. Anyway, we've gone around and around. So I think what you're saying, the best part is somehow get him to do a worksheet on his own, because he still sees me as the one who's lecturing him and pushing him, even though I'm really a lot better. I'm not doing it. I'm just suggesting and say, oh, you know, that's an idea. What about that? It's just not taking him where he needs to go yet. And maybe it won't happen while I'm here. Yeah.
Yeah. And probably the reason why the conversation stopped and he went downstairs is because he can see how he'd have to be the one pushing his brother.
No kidding. And he also knows that here we are paying his rent and paying for his school. Tim's supporting him totally. And he knows he's using And he did say, well, at least I don't blow up at people. I'm a sweet drunk. And, you know, it's
well,
like,
that might
well,
be the time to offer him, you know, are you interested in some really honest feedback? Let me show you some of the texts you've sent me. Excuse me, son. This is not sweetness. You've got to stop lying to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, just you've got the text. You can turn to the text with the vicious things
that
you said. It's like, excuse me, this is not sweetness. And if you don't know this, then you've really been out of your mind with your drugs and alcohol, and you better really start to pay attention to what you're doing to yourself. Because here it is. Here it is in writing. This is your text.
Yeah.
And doing that from a space of care and concern and active present love, not a whine, not a complaint, just and at the same time, you know, pointing out to him, one of the reasons you have so much pain is because you're vicious. And when you're vicious, you get the original of that energy and it stays with you. And if you stop that, you're going to start to unwind your pain and free yourself from that pain. And he's also, I suspect, bright enough. I mean, I can certainly understand that he'd say, well, this is all fake. When you show him that poster, it's like, son, you need to stop the lies to yourself. This is one of the top psychiatrists in the world working with brain scans. And these are actual pictures of people's brains. And, you know, you're kidding yourself if you think this man has faked all of this for you. It's just, you know, I mean, this man's done hundreds of thousands of brain scans, is a globally known psychiatrist. And besides that, I know him personally. And it's a man with a great deal of compassion and concern for people.
Yeah.
So you can assure him of that. And you know, maybe that would be a place to educate him a little bit on his denial system. You know, that's just a way that you avoid looking at the truth. But this man doesn't publish this thing so that you can be exposed to a lie. He publishes it so that you can see the truth of here's what it does to the brain.
Mm.
And you can stop doing that to your brain.
Oh, Michael, I need a lot of courage.
You're definitely taking, you know, you're exposing your heart to a young man that's proven that he can be pretty violent and pretty vicious. And it sounds like you're gently opening a space. And again, I get the way that you're approaching him is, as opposed to lecturing him or coming from a place of blame, you're coming from a place of deep concern, you know, and you can express that. This is coming from deep concern. You've told me, gee, you've got this problem and you want help with it. But when I come with help, you deny the veracity of the help. And if you really, truly want help, it's time to start to change your own thinking, because your thinking's in error.
Yeah.
So, once again, we'll hold the space.
Thanks.
And I lament with you on what's happening with Luke, that's still going on. I know there were some signs that he was maybe bringing his head up above water or alcohol and starting to wake up. And it sounds like he's still pretty steeped in that
pain and trauma. Yeah, well, his girlfriend, she was wonderful, but she was also a drinker. His girlfriend had enough and drove off with her car and left him stranded. And that was a good thing. So anyway, I guess it was a good thing. Who knows? But he's probably just devastated. But he needs to be protected now too, from himself. I mean, he needs to be kept safe for a while until he can get his brain straight on. Thank you, Michael. Again, man, I'm amazed that half the country isn't calling in with their SOSs. I seem to have more than my share of SOSs for you. So thanks for fielding them.
Well, it's an honor and a delight to be here to support you, and I appreciate the fact that you open your heart as deeply as you do and share what you do, because it's for a lot of people who really don't have the courage or don't have the wherewithal to call in, or, you know, are just hiding out in their own dissociated minds. It's a powerful way for people to build the brain cells and to start to recoup their own lives. To me, the recognition when anyone recognizes that whatever they've been told about themselves, who they really are, is created active love. That's just the truth. I don't care if we're talking about Hitler or Mussolini or Trump or, you know, Bush or any of them. You know, we're all in the same boat. We're all humans. We're all made of the same active present love. And the lies we've been told about ourselves, that self that Yeshua says, in order for you to live, you've got to die. Is we have to die to the lying part of ourselves and the part that's been given just silly, ridiculous, hateful messages by power persons and generations of patterns and culture. The culture also has its share of lies that it offers. We watched, I had posted, you know, we talked last week about the movie, It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And I posted it on Facebook, and someone posted that they had watched and found it to be very enjoyable. The movie, there's another movie that
Will You Be My Neighbor?
Will You Be My Neighbor, another Mr. Rogers movie. And it basically
Nothing
is
wrong
kind
with
of the
your
story
noodle,
of Mr.
Jeannie.
Right. And so we watched this the other night, this person, and I'd forgotten that we'd watched it several years ago when it came out, but it basically is Mr. Rogers' story, how he became who he is, and some of the things he did, some of the glass ceilings that he broke, you know, he's, you know, one scene that strikes me that was so powerful, and there's the black man who played the role of the policeman, and Mr. Rogers is sitting with a little kiddie pool and he's washing his feet, and the policeman, who's a black man, comes in and they're talking, and he's like, yeah, this is so wonderful, washing my feet, so why don't you take your shoes off and wash your feet with me? And like, that was a shocker in America to have a black man sitting with a white man,
so gorgeous.
And the white man toweled off the black man's feet. And, you know, what a shocker that was to the television audience. But, and then toward the end of it, one of the people I recognized is a Fox, one of their morning hosts. And they were saying some of the just horrific things that were said about Mr. Rogers and how he created a whole generation of entitled kids because he told them they were special without having to work their asses off for it. And, you know, I mean, they reviewed some editorials that were written that were just scathing. How dare this man tell children that they're special and they're loved. And they are valuable. How dare, you know, I mean, and that mindset's out there, you know, trying to take over the country, trying to take over the world. It's just bizarre. But the lies people have been told, it's tough to not believe them when the person who's your power person, the person who's supposed to be your caretaker, gives you those kinds of messages so deeply and oftentimes reinforced with deep physical, mental, and emotional pain. It can be tough to face those things. So, you know, the fact that you have the courage to bring that forward and share that and to keep this conversation going, not just for yourself, but for everybody who's listening and who will listen in the future, I think is a phenomenal gift that I'm certainly delighted that we get to receive from you. So thank you.
Hello, welcome. That's a nice way to put a spin on it. Yeah.
Well, it's true. Oh. It's a tough conversation to have. And I appreciate the fact that you keep coming back layer after layer, piece after piece, and doing your work and opening space for these young men to heal. it sounds like, you know, we haven't heard any traumas from your son for some time, and I think you were successful in supporting him and opening in another space for him to express, and it sounds like his life is rocking forward.
It is. You know, he's working, he's on call, and he says it's just a wild, wild zoo at the hospital. But he's doing what he loves. He comes home exhausted, but he's a different person. I don't worry about him anymore, knock on wood. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Awesome. And I think, you know, when I think back to the processing that you did around that and the conversations you shared you had with him, you were the catalyst for his healing. So I hold the space that you can be as successful with these two young men as you were with him. And if you can't, that you can cancel that goal and reach into deeper and deeper parts of being the space in a situation where most people could do nothing else but turn to their pain.
Yeah. Yeah, canceling that goal. I'm remembering those words. Those are good words. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well.
All right, my dear.
Okay, well, I'm going to go down and take my worksheet with me. I got it on a clipboard. So
all right.
I'll give
we'll
you
be
a
holding
the
space.
When we got...
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thanks so
you.
Much. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank
Lots
you,
of love.
Too.
Blessings.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye.
It's such a profound thing to do for someone who's living in addiction, in pain and trauma, with seemingly nowhere to go, to find and remember the truth of who they are, and to recognize that everything that runs us based in pain is based in a lie. And it takes tremendous courage to face that lie and start to let it go, because you have to face what went down with your power person to do that. And it's huge. It takes a sincere and committed effort to let go of those deeply embedded lies about who we are and to surface as the presence of love. It's a huge piece of work. And we're here to hold the space for that to happen for every mind, heart, and being on the planet. I just, you know, I hold the space, I hold the visualization of the day when 7.5 billion people on planet Earth wake up remembering who they are as love, remembering who the people around them are as love. And I'm talking about the most vicious of minds being able to do that and then function out of that love. That's my dream. I have a dream. That was a powerful piece of work Martin Luther King did. He set a vision. So what's your dream? What's your question about how to achieve your dream? Is there something we can do to support you with these tools in bringing your dream forward into the world? And is your dream based in love? And if it's not, then we invite you to forgive that dream. That is, remove it from your mind and make the space for a different dream to enter. Make the space for that higher part of your mind to open and bring you gifts beyond what you could imagine out of the self that isn't. So if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you're listening to the show, great. Let's say hello.
I think it's Michael Teddy, 770. You're on the air.
Hi, folks.
Hey, good afternoon, young man. How are you?
Doing good. A little on the warm side, but well. How are y'all doing today?
Good. Good. Got up early while it was cool and did a few hours work in the garden. And we're rocking.
Yes, I understand that. I started early myself. Ended a little after noon here. And just for those wondering, it's 98 right now, heading for 102 again.
That's
so
crazy.
It's been warm for, it's been like this for weeks now.
I don't remember a summer that has ever been that crazy out there. It's just time for us to wake up and what we're doing to the planet.
Yeah, things are definitely changing. Things are definitely changing. Well, I heard some interesting conversation. Very blessed by it. But let's, I know we got a few minutes left today. What is a dream based in love? Tell us a little about that, Michael. That kind of caught my attention. And for those of us like me that have not stopped dreaming, what if it's based in love, I guess it would have to be beneficial to humanity, right?
It would be. It would be in harmony with truth. It would be in harmony with love. And every interaction that would happen out of it would be based in a loving interaction. And that would mean the dissolution of everything to do with hostility and fear. So human beings coming forward in the face of those situations where yesterday it was easy to find somebody to blame and their name was always them, that one would come forward recognizing that blame is a falsity and have the willingness to take responsibility for any kind of falsity that one owns, recognizing this cycle of deny, dissociate, project. The dream of hostility or fear comes from one who thinks or speaks as though something happening inside of them is caused by someone or something outside of them. So, you know, kind of my tongue-in-cheek line if I were doing a workshop would be, so is there somebody in your life, if they change, your life would get better, would be fine. And then I usually inject, when several of them laugh and hold their hands up, I inject liar, liar, pants on fire. Because the belief that the reason I'm in pain or I'm in turmoil or things aren't going the way I want them to do is somebody else's fault is literally denial. And recognizing when I hold that belief that the very thing with which I'm causing my own pain, in order to hold that belief as true, in order to be able, my mind to be able to construct that belief that the reason things aren't going well is because of somebody else, I have to dissociate from the cause of my own pain, and that makes my pain unresolvable. And by dissociating it from it, I have to press down on it. You know, let's imagine we've got a 3-foot diameter spring and it stands 3 feet tall. Can that spring sitting on the floor do anything? Absolutely nothing.
Wow.
But if I push down on it and then I lock it in place, and I push down on that spring and lock it in place, and I push down in that spring and I lock it in place, and then I get 3 or 4 big guys to come and really, we're going to crank that 3-foot diameter spring down tight and lock it, what happens when I let the lock off? Kaboom, there's an explosion of energy.
Something's going to launch.
Mm-hmm. Something's going to launch. So when I hold, you know, the way we lock the spring down is by thinking or speaking blame of somebody else is the cause of what's happening inside of me. Now, when I speak that, my mind will gladly build me a picture that shows me, yep, they're the reason I'm in this pain. They're the reason there's a problem. But what I unconsciously have done is I've dissociated from that spring inside myself that holds that pain, and I've pushed down and I've locked it and I've locked it. And every time I have that conversation, I put more potential energy into it and lock it down once again, which means that out of that set of brain cells that I've dissociated from, having pushed down on it so much, there's so much potential energy in it that literally the high energy wave that leaves the mind from the movement of that energy in me, that intensified, amplified energy in me, the high energy wave, and it's literally a measurable actual energy wave, is intensified. So I just took that creative energy in me that I've dissociated from, and I've turned it into a silent scream. Screaming, you know, the deeper I've pushed it down, the deeper the scream is for somebody with a matching bag of garbage to come and spew it on me. And then when they do spew it on me, they will show up. You can rest assured. The guarantee of the Creator is, here's my take of the guarantee the Creator gives us. I will not allow you to get away with killing yourself without warning you over and over and over again. And here's your warning. Somebody's going to come up and bring that pain up for you again. But what happens to the person who's in denial is the energy or the information inside themselves that they've dissociated from, when this person responds to the psychic megaphone message sent out by that intensified, dissociated energy, when they respond and do whatever it is that they do, they resonate that dissociated energy in us, and then we use that dissociated energy to build a construct of them. So we use our own dissociated pain to build our brain's image of them, and so now, literally, I have a picture in my mind of them carrying the pain that I've dissociated from. And I swear it must be theirs because, look, I can see it. I actually see it with my eyes. I think I see it with my eyes. My brain produces it as a construct. And so they show up in my mind with my problem attached, and I swear it must be their problem. I go into another cycle of blame, and if they just change, everything would be all right in my life. And I just push that energy, dissociated from that energy, one more time on another level. It's like, and dissociation is like having a computer, and I write this beautiful story, and I put a password on the file. I close the file down and I burn the password. I cannot access that story again. I'll never be able to open that file without the password. What one dissociates from, and back in the early days, and I mean for 30 years, when I did the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, and you've watched that. I think you watched that 3-hour video that we did recently. At the top of the board, you know, in that workshop you saw recently, you saw deny, dissociate, project. For the first 30 years, the three words at the top of the board were deny, suppress, project. Because I thought in the early days of doing this work that it was just a suppression mechanism. But then I was instructed, I got direct instruction from Ruka, no. And it was that distinct that, Michael, it is not suppression, it's dissociation. And the difference is, if I've suppressed something, well, okay, I can just undo my suppression. But if I've dissociated from something, I've thrown away the password for that content. And there is only one password that will allow recovery and healing of that dissociated content. And the password is Yeshua's first century Aramaic forgiveness. It's the only way.
That is huge. You
access the password. It's huge.
I
mean,
huge,
to me, you know, with having worked with this. Say again?
That's huge. I'm kind of blown away here, the difference between suppressing something and disassociation.
Yeah, and it's actually not disassociation. That's a different thing, disassociation. It's a dissociation. So when I dissociate from something, it's no longer mine. And, you know, my take is, you know, you look at the state of the world, how global warming is being ignored. You look at the violence and the viciousness and the rhetoric of politics or just people on the street. You look at the violence in movies. You look at starvation around the world. You look at refugees around the world. You look at dictators and murder. There is only one reason for that. All of that, my take. And it's because these people don't have forgiveness. They don't know how to. Once they've acquired a pained mind and they've dissociated from it by blaming someone else, they don't know how to access it. They don't know how to get rid of it. And it's passed on from generation to generation to generation. If we could overnight wand the world and hand them the actual teaching of Yeshua on forgiveness, getting rid of this whole Greek idea that it's got anything to do with letting anybody else off the hook, but it's a password for accessing one's own pained content, one's own dissociated content, and processing through it, the world would shift overnight and those problems would disappear because people would show up as human beings rather than showing up as false, pained, feeble, weak, blaming non-humans. And the difference to me between a human and a non-human, you know, the form is the same. The appearance of the form is the same. The difference is where there is act present love in what we call a human form, there is a human life. Where love is not conscious, active, and present, there is no human life. If that form is run by a false self, the self that Yeshua 2,000 years ago said, in order for you, human life, to live, you, non-human life, have to die. You have to remove, get rid of, or die to that self that's running the game. And you look at how many people, their conversation is about rage and fear and pain and trauma and blame and hatred and vengeance and war. I mean, people are talking about, well, you know, when do we get to kill? When do we get to get our guns out and shoot these political enemies? I mean, right here in America, there are people saying things like that. There's no human life in those people. And others, you know, there are certainly issues that need to be resolved. And sometimes people who are saying things like, when do we get to shoot those people that are doing this to us, the ones they're blaming? And they're talking about really valid, serious issues. But anybody who's following someone who's thinking, when do we get to shoot them? When do we get to do the violence to them? It's not human. And there's no resolution to that. There's just the exacerbation of insanity until we end up with dictatorship. Because the only way to run a society where everybody's dissociated from their own pain is somebody has to be the strong man and beat people down who open their mouths and get in the way, who don't obey. There's got to be that kind of authority and control. When we wake up and we start to function as humans, there's no authority needed. The authority is the presence of active love. And people don't do that. You know, there's a T.S. Eliot, philosopher, wrote a little phrase about the word propitiation. And propitiation, his poem was, 'tis the highest treason to do the right thing for the wrong reason. People who live in a dissociated state do the right thing for the wrong reason, and by doing the right thing for the wrong reason, they create disease and pain and trauma for themselves, even when they're doing the right things, because they're doing it out of dissociated pain, and they simply replicate the dissociated pain, even trying to do the right things. So much of that has rubbed off and become what we call churchianity today. And the show's going to cut us off in a minute or so, but That, to me, is where the problem and where the solution lies.
Michael,
and I'll give you the last word. We've got about 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was just going to ask you if you would spell this dissociation.
D-I-S S, let's see, C-I-A-T-I-O-N.
I need to look at that. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, if you watch the 3-hour, yeah, if you watch the 3-hour, why is this happening to me again, that link again, that's where I go. I start out moving in, and you'll see that ends up on the board for the rest of the workshop.
Okay.
So I talk about how that happens again.
Powerful.
All right, my friend. Well, I'm pleasantly surprised. The radio show should have cut us off about 10 seconds ago, but it's let us go over. So let's carry the conversation on, sir.
We can go on. Wonderful. Michael,
Well, I'm thinking tomorrow. It's going to cut it. We're going to disappear any second.
Gotcha.
Monday, pardon me. Yeah, today is Friday.
I'll make my notes.
Yes.